Welcome to the Currency.News Energy Matters podcast, powered by Pinergy.
Hello and welcome to Energy Matters, a podcast brought to you by The Currency and powered by Pinergy. My name is Ian Keogh, and over the course of this series, we're investigating the Irish and international energy sector, how we've reached the point we're in, what we could have done better in the past, and crucially, what we can do in the future. In this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Jonah Goldman. Jonah, you're very welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Look, just to give some background to our listeners, Jonah, you previously worked with Gates Ventures, where you were responsible for the organization's relationship with policymakers all over the world. Then in another Bill Gates-backed venture, you were CEO of Breakthrough Energy, which is a very prominent umbrella organization. It was founded with the aim of accelerating innovation in sustainable energy and to come up with new technologies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. More recently, in recent months, you've moved on again and you've launched North Cascade Strategies, which is working with innovators, advocates, governments and companies to invest in a net zero future. So it's quite a big and an important backstory. And we're going to talk about that over the course of this podcast. But I want to start somewhat left field. Indiana Jones, or more specifically, Raiders of the Lost Ark. You're laughing. You know where I'm going with this.
I do.
Because I was preparing for this interview and I was reading something you put up on LinkedIn called The Wisdom of Salah. And maybe you might just explain what prompted you to put it up there, but also what you were saying in your post, because I think it'll give us a great grounding to some of the issues that we're going to be talking about over the course of this podcast.
Yeah. So thanks so much. I must have been 7 or 8 years old when Raiders of the Lost Ark came out, and I just fell in love with the movie. And there was a time when I thought I wanted to be an archaeologist because of it. So it's a frequent reference point for me. And as the world was getting ready to go to COP27, where folks are just finishing up now, I was struck again by all of what I thought of as sort of preemptive disappointment that the world was looking towards as we went to yet another COP where there was more of these commitments that had been made years earlier, and we'd been disappointed by the outcome of those commitments. And as I think about climate change, and this has always been the way that I've thought about the issue, I've been sort of singularly focused on the goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions to zero. And I was trying to think about how closely I thought the disappointment was actually correlated with the goal. And in my mind, it's actually, and this is why I brought up that the Indiana Jones piece, where there's a scene in the movie where the two main characters are realize that their antagonists are literally digging in the wrong place because they don't have all of the information, because they have this counterfeit map that they were using in order to find the Ark of the Covenant. And I feel very similarly when it comes to our climate goals. So what I mean very specifically by that is almost all of the climate goals that both the private sector and the public sector are judged by are individual goals. So does a particular firm or a particular country, is it getting itself closer to either zero or net zero greenhouse gas emissions? And while that seems like it's a very noble endeavor, the truth is that a particular company, and to large extent, even a particular country, is not dramatically relevant in the climate space. We need the entire world to get to zero. And so the mechanisms that you would use in order to get a country or a company, more importantly, in this, for the purpose of the piece that I was writing, but to get to zero is not necessarily what you need to get the world to zero. So for example, if you're making investments and one of the things that I think I referenced in the piece was, if you take a look at Amazon, Amazon made a significant investment in a EV startup called Rivian. And that investment was largely designed to bring to market relatively quickly for the time, in-town delivery vans. So, we're talking about the last mile deliveries when you order, obviously, from Amazon, last mile delivery. those vans, according to the net zero commitment that Amazon.com had made, are only relevant to the replacement of the internal combustion engine vans that they are replacing. And so that's actually a relatively small amount of Amazon's carbon footprint. But because they made that deal and they invested billions of dollars into the company, it started a healthy competition. And so then you see Stellantis and you see Daimler-Benz and you see all of these other companies coming out with electrified in-town delivery vehicles. And because of, in large part, not entirely because of, but in large part because of that transaction, the investment in Rivian and Amazon's commitment to put those vans on the street, we are probably going to eliminate last mile delivery emissions. It's not a huge amount of emissions, but it's a significant amount of emissions. And to me, that's way more important than whatever impact the replacement of an in-town delivery van that's electrified for an in-town delivery van that's an internal combustion engine could ever mean to a company's carbon footprint. It just is way more important that we're doing the activities that are going to create the market for new products that are net zero products. And because so much of what these commitments end up doing is triggering real investments of real money into real things, what we count matters. And when we count things that are only myopically myopic in the sense that we're only looking at our own footprint, we're going to end up putting money into things that are not as important as the things that could really lead to global decarbonization.
And I suppose that makes the point about that sort of the link in between government, between, you know, the private and public sectors, because you can't have, you know, politicians and policymakers going off to COP or whatever the latest conference is, you know, outlining their vision. But it really is industry has to step up to the plate on a lot of this, on a lot of these new technologies.
Absolutely. I mean, we're in a different situation when it comes to the energy transition related to climate. So in at least the last couple hundred years, our global economic system has relied on a pretty traditional capitalist sort of outlook where things are replaced when they're either cheaper or better than the things that came before them. So, you know, we end up with cheaper and better, energy sources, or our cars get cheaper and better, or our building materials get cheaper and better. And so then we replace whatever came before them. But with climate, it's a different thing. We actually often have to replace things that themselves are cheaper or better with something that might even be more expensive and less good at the underlying thing that we're asking it to do, but it solves this climate parameter. And so, for example, a great example is like, if it weren't for climate, coal would be actually a decent way to make electricity. We've figured out how to deal with some of the localized pollution issues with coal. And it burns 24 hours a day, and it's reliable, and it's all of that. And we know how to build coal. We know how to build coal plants, but it's terrible when it comes to climate change. So it's being replaced by things that are much better for that parameter, wind and solar. But wind and solar, of course, are not 24-hour; they're intermittent sources. So the only way that these transitions happen is if markets are given a clear directive, and that clear directive is almost always going to come from policy. But that doesn't mean that policy supplants the innovation and deployment opportunities that the private sector knows so much better than the government sector does. So it really has to be a kind of hand in glove relationship between the public and private sectors, which is sometimes uncomfortable. And we've figured it out how to do it in some places, and we've stumbled in others, and that will continue to be the case as we move forward in this endeavor. But we have to realize that government can't be afraid of the private sector, and the private sector can't be afraid of government when it comes to climate. We have to think about how these can be collaborative.
And I will come back to that and that market imperative in a moment. I just want to take a step back, Jonah, to your own background for a moment before we get into some of the specifics. You might talk to us about your work with Bill Gates, working with him, and also with Breakthrough Energy. And what was kind of the stimulus for that organization and its work?
Yeah. So Breakthrough started in 2015 in the lead up to the Paris COP, the one that was the first time where we saw a global agreement on climate to really focus on emissions reductions, which was certainly a historic accomplishment for the world. So what Bill saw at that point, and I was working with him as you mentioned earlier, in his private office, was that there was very little focus on innovation. And so there was most of the focus in the Paris climate talks were focused on the technologies that we had that we knew worked. So solar and wind, largely EVs, the things that we have come sort of ubiquitous in the climate discussion. But there are all of these other sources of emissions that people seem to not be talking about, that we really weren't ready to start the process of replacement of the underlying technology. So we're talking about the building blocks of our modern economy. We're talking about steel and cement and liquid fuel and plastics and the things that that people take for granted. But if anyone is looking around a room or a car or wherever they're listening to this podcast, and you look not only at the things that are turning on your lights, but everything that's made, all of those things contributed to climate change. And they really are the fundamental building blocks of how we build economies. And so one of the problems that we saw was that there was not enough attention being paid to the early stage innovations to figure out how you build those products in a way that were cheap enough for the world to adopt them and quick enough that we were able to do it on a climate timeline. And so we went to the Paris COP. We had great support from governments as well as from private sector investments with this with the suggestion that we had that if governments increased their commitments to research and development, that we, largely through Bill's leadership, would increase private sector investments, largely venture capital investments, into those technologies to build those companies. Over the course of the next 7 years, we built multiple different pieces that surrounded that venture kind of theory, where not only were these companies being created, but we needed to have creative approaches to feed the innovation pipeline. So that included building something called Breakthrough Energy Fellows, which is an earlier stage, a kind of a pre-venture stage investment in early technologies. And then also another thing that we did on the back end was to build a program called Catalyst, which was investing in the high risk, first of a kind projects that are very expensive to build, to basically prove the commercialization thesis of many of these companies. And then in addition to that, we had sort of at each of these levels, there was a sophisticated government relations advocacy and lobbying effort in order to make sure that there were the rules and regulations to be able to encourage this type of transition. I'm sorry, please.
No. So you're kind of coming into that piece because we see it. We've seen it in Ireland a lot where, very clever people have a very clever idea in the green tech area. And they get to a point, but it then comes to a point somebody has to either write a massive check to commercialize them. I mean, a massive check. But in most cases, they simply shut it down or sort of sell off their IP. So where you were stepping in was to try and help them do the commercialization piece.
That's right. Yeah. So, most of the time, at least in the kind of the popular mind about the process of a company or a technology, we very much focus on kind of Silicon Valley and information technology and the technology revolution. And people just expect, and I mean people meaning, anywhere from a casual observer to investors to entrepreneurs, they think that process is available for all different types of technology areas. And that process is a very capital light process. So it's very easy to invest in a company that is a app developer when there's one or two people in a garage or in a dorm room, and they're basically creating intellectual property through software. That's a very capital light investment. And you can make hundreds of them, and if one of them hits, that's amazing, and likely many of them will hit. But that's pretty much what you need to do. And then you need to invest in, obviously, other software developers and a little bit of infrastructure. These companies are exactly the opposite from that. These companies we're talking about, you need to invest early at high, high dollars because the lab equipment is expensive and the educational situations that these innovators are coming out of is, you know, super expensive. And then from there, you've now proven the very earliest stages of the technology. And so there continues to be technical risk as you scale up a bench lab experiment all the way up to a first of a kind commercial demonstration plant. And these things are tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. And you've not yet proven that the technology works at scale, that the engineering works, and that the market is available. And so if those are the parameters that you're trying to invest, there aren't that many people willing to take that investment risk, even though everybody knows that climate change is happening and that, you know, we're at risk of this catastrophic fallout if we continue to push the envelope beyond 1.5 degrees. But it's still, from an investment perspective, from the traditional way that people judge investments, it's a very risky proposition. And so you don't see money flowing there. And that's the fundamental problem. And that's the reason why you need a different type of pressure in order to cause those resources to come. And that's where largely policy does make a huge difference. I mean, we've seen amazing things happening with policy, both here in the United States, as well as in Europe and in parts of Asia. You know, the recovery from COVID has certainly been, the economic incentives to recover from COVID have certainly been a green recovery. I mean, there's been way more resources. There's been an understanding from policymakers that this is a particularly bad part of the investment cycle, trying to get these first of a kind commercial plants up and running. And so there's been a lot of resources from it, but you're still in a position where there are still safer alternative investments for investors. And you know, investors are inherently not risk tolerant, or they try to be as little risk tolerant as they can be. And so we're still in a part where we haven't gotten it perfect. We've certainly gotten it better.
I want to come back to that piece around the commercial opportunities, the potential wall of capital in a moment. But listen, we'll give you the elevator pitch for your new business, North Cascade Strategies. What is it? What are you hoping to do with it?
Well, right now, I'm actually just in the very, very early stages of figuring out how I can work with partners. I'm mostly, I spent a decade building Breakthrough. I took some time this summer, which I was incredibly happy to be out in the mountains where me and my family love to be to spend time with my family. And then now I'm just sort of getting back into having conversations with partners about how I can do just this, how I can help them with creatively thinking about what commercialization opportunities are for these really tough technologies, and how you bring together incentives from policy to we have other potential significant issues, which are also sort of policy based, which is, as I think of as sort of downstream policy. So once we get to the resources to finance these big plants, they still are coming into heavily regulated industries around the world. And those regulations were not built for these new types of products. They were built for whatever legacy product it's trying to replace. So I'm going to work with some partners on how to think of reshaping some of those more localized policies, as well as creative investment strategies to think about. Okay. Please.
No. And we'll let's get into the weeds on some of those things. So,
sure,
you know,
sure.
Look, we want to get to net zero emissions by 2050. It's an admirable and an essential goal and ambition. How do we get there? If you had a wish list of things that we could do, where should we be starting on that journey?
Well, the first place to start, I mean, you always want to start with the easiest stuff and get the easiest stuff done. And the easiest stuff right now are the places where we're making just tremendous progress, which of course are electrified vehicles and general increasing of clean electricity. So whether that is renewable electricity or advanced nuclear, like we are in a process right now of understanding how to how to build those things, how to build them big, and how to build them in a cheap way so they're actually economic. We should be doing everything we possibly can to expand the adoption of those technologies. And then we should recognize that part of the adoption of those technologies mean making it easier to do some of the critical ancillary parts of that puzzle, which include transmission. So transmission would definitely be one of my wishes. So, you know, big power lines going across long distances that are higher voltage, that are able to carry more of the types of electricity that we need further distances, because, you know, now we have, especially from a renewable perspective, now we have location-dependent energy creation, which we didn't in the last generation of energy creation. So that's the first thing of the hard things to do would be transmission. The second thing is what we were just talking about, where we need to, in the short term, incentivize risk-taking at the large project stage, largely for first-of-a-kind commercial plants. And that's in a bunch of different technologies. It's in steel, it's in clean cement, it's in sustainable aviation fuel, it's in other types of low or zero carbon liquid fuels. But right now, we haven't created the investment incentives enough to encourage people to put real resources at a massive scale into some of those technologies. And then the third thing I'd say is a real effort to build out a economy and market related to carbon capture and storage, because despite the fact that, you know, some people look at that as a kind of a cop out to doing the hard stuff for the decarbonization that we need, there's no future scenario where we get to net zero where we don't rely heavily on capturing carbon and storing it back in the ground. And so we have to create that economy, because it's an utterly unnatural economy. There's no value to carbon that we put back into the earth. So, but those are the sort of the big pillars, I think.
And just in relation to that commercial piece, it's really interesting. It's kind of striking when you're talking about it. Everybody knows they need to invest in the sort of technologies you've been talking about. And there's a potential massive financial return, a wall of capital. But at the same time, there is that underlying skepticism and fear about going into virgin technologies for fear of losing a significant sum of money. You were talking about, you know, potential incentives or subsidies. That's going to, I suppose, require a more multinational, I suppose, approach to this, not just country A, country B.
One of the things I like to think of when I think about climate is that oftentimes people force the conversation, because it's easy, into a kind of a binary, an either or. None of this stuff is either or. We need all of this stuff. We need a better functioning multilateral system to make sure that there are consistent incentives over longer periods of time, which is one of the problems with the nature of politics in most of the developed world, is that these things are cyclical and people are making promises for when they don't see themselves in that political future, and so they make easy promises, but they don't come through. And so certainly we need a better structure for multilateralism. But at the point of a lot of these technologies, despite the fact that they need to be global in adoption, they can be local in their testing. And so a lot of the resources are going to likely come at a national level, but they're globally minded in the sense that, you know, I can speak from the U.S. that just made this historic investment in a lot of these technologies. The reason why politicians here made that investment is because the size of the market globally is tremendous. If that adoption can be had by any one of these particular operators, and whatever country decides to make that investment and develop that those technologies and develop that industry is gonna be a win in the long term. So, but again, these things aren't alternatives. They're all additional.
Yeah, and we talk about, that's the long term. In the short term, you look at it, China's putting more money into coal factories. I mean, oil and gas stocks are off the charts at the moment. Sky high profits, shares are doing really well. Do you think that's going to, temper investment in new climate technologies?
Yeah. So, I mean, there seems to be some level of resilience, but that level of resilience has largely been during the boom times of the last, you know, decade of economic success. We're obviously turning a corner, unfortunately, in the global economic situation. So we'll see what impact that has. You know, at some point, people are one of the, I think, big blind spots for policymakers at every level. So I don't just mean the public sector, but I also mean policymakers in the private sector, whether that's, you know, corporate leaders or investment leaders. One of the big blind spots is that they're not really seeing the impact that a generational shift in thinking is likely to have on markets. So that what I mean by that is that if you look at the role that climate plays in the generation that's making decision now, it's always been ancillary to other largely economic factors. So that's to say, we, including my generation, see climate through an economic lens. So all these conversations that we've had today and all the conversations at COP and all the conversations that the world has been shaped through that lens.
Okay.
But what you see the younger generation doing is that they sort of flip that. They see economics through a climate lens. And that seems like a potentially interesting, it might be boring, but it's a potentially interesting thing to write some kind of academic paper on. But it's very meaningful when it comes to a market perspective, likely in the long term. And the way that it's meaningful is that you see that generation. So we're talking about people in their from late 20s to teenagers right now. Those people are making fundamental life decisions based on climate impact. So you see them having conversations, and there's a lot of research about this. You see them having conversations about whether to have kids, where to live, what jobs to take, largely based on an anxiety about climate change. There's actually a really good book written called Generation Dread that's focused on how this generation is terrified of the future because of climate. That sort of mindset shift will lead that generation to make fundamentally different policy decisions. So that's to say, the things that we think are off the table, like a globally border adjusted carbon price, where you know we always have people who are talking about it, it's never politically feasible. In 10 to 15 years, that's going to be a relatively easy decision for that generation to make. And their decision-making power is growing exponentially. It's growing as consumers, it's growing as employees, and eventually it'll be growing as company leaders as well as policymakers. And so things like renewable fuel standards or renewable portfolio standards or renewable product or clean product standards, those things right now, which have proven to shift markets on the margin because we're only really making that policy on the margin, will be core to how that generation makes decisions. So right now we're fighting a battle to try to figure out where the role of clean steel is in a market dominated by dirty steel. But if that generation comes to power and decides that we don't want to have dirty steel, then all of a sudden there's not an alternative. There's only the clean product. And we know that we can do that because we're seeing that happen in EVs. We're seeing it happen in Europe, in California, in New York, with these huge markets saying that they're not going to be selling internal combustion engines after 2035. That's a big indicator of the types of policies that we're likely to see moving forward with generations that are even more motivated by climate. But investors haven't really looked beyond just those narrow places where we've already made those policies.
And I suppose even, look, I'm guilty of that even in having this conversation with you, and we're looking at it through the lens of a commercial and what we can do. But, you know, capitalism will, you know, pivot to deal with the demands of a new generation of people coming through with different aspirations, different ideals, and those people will end up leading these companies themselves.
Yes, yeah, for sure. And it's not It sounds kind of like a, you know, like a hope for the future, which of course it is. I mean, like
Gen Z to the rescue, you know?
Yeah, Gen Z to the rescue. It sounds like something somewhat fanciful or naive. It's really not. And the reason why I really believe that it's not fanciful or naive is because it's not like we don't have indications of the direction that this generation is going. We have very clear indications. They're making it very clear. And again, it's not an ancillary issue for them. It is the core issue, and it cuts across national boundaries. It cuts across political boundaries. It cuts across religious boundaries. Like if you're looking at it from a political science perspective, it's a very durable issue. And if you're looking at it from a market perspective, this generation's already making significant market demands that are related to this issue. So like there's a good chance that given the opportunity, they're going to make some pretty significant decisions in that time period. So then if you're looking at it from an investor today, and you have investments in significant infrastructure that are long-lived infrastructure, you know, we're talking 20, 30, 40, 50 years infrastructure, you have to consider that reality in the future as you're thinking about making these investments now. And all of a sudden, it seems like if you're going to get in on the early side of some of these higher risk investments, which are higher risk, higher capital, like we were talking about before, some of these, you know, early stage commercial types of investments, if you're able to get in early, you're going to see the engineering, you're going to have major engineering lessons that you learn from the early deployment of some of these things. You're going to understand the markets, you'll understand upstream and downstream and life cycles. All of those things are going to be hugely valuable as the ability for fossil fuel dependent products get constrained in the market because of these other forces, and you'll have the ability to take advantage of that. So I actually think that there's a pretty productive investment case. But you have to look down the field. And, you know, as we know, investors are just not good at looking down the field too long.
No. Yeah. No, they're not. Listen, finally, Jonah, look, we've had a love affair with fossil fuels for a couple of hundred years. We've seen the outcome of it now. You've been studying this. You've been working with companies, with policymakers, politicians, advocates, everyone else for, you know, more than a decade. When you look at it, over the next 10, 20, 30 years, what does the future of energy look like? I know it's a big, wide-ranging question, but it's something I'm really interested to hear your view on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the first thing is that we have to realize that, you know, fossil fuels built every, you know, all of the institutions that we take for granted. So I do want to make sure that we're realistic about the role that those companies have played in our modern lifestyle, that the policies that have created that have played in our modern lifestyle. And I don't look for villains in this so much as I look for, you know, saviors. And I think that the answer to where we're going to be in the next 10 or 15 years is, you know, climate is going to continue every year to climate change, I should say, is going to continue every year to be more and more ever present in our lives and is going to force more and more decisions. And to the extent that we can use that as an opportunity to say, well, we need to rapidly advance our thinking in how these industries are developed, I think that's a positive. And I think that, but it's coming out of like, it's a faint silver lining in a very dark cloud. I mean, we're talking about the fact that, you know, obviously you in Europe are right now dealing with the kind of dual crises of the geopolitical turmoil together with climate change and what that means to energy prices and availability of clean of energy, period. But, you know, here we've had, you know, two times in 3 years, 1,000-year floods in parts of the country, and we have 1,000-year droughts in other parts of the country. And those climate impacts are just going to bring into stark relief the fact that the, you know, every time, every moment of delay means that those things are going to get worse and worse. And so hopefully there's an opportunity to say, well, let's rethink how we're doing some of these core things like investing and building markets and those sorts of things And we start moving in the right direction.
Great. Well, look, at Jonah Goldman, I really want to thank you for joining me here from Seattle on Energy Matters, the podcast series brought to you by The Currency and powered by Pinergy. That's Jonah Goldman. So, Jonah, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Currency.News Energy Matters podcast, powered by Pinergy.